I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
Earlier this year, we came together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 2, The Squeeze. Dear Bill, I'm writing this on a cold but very sunny Saturday morning here in England, and I just knocked my drink over twice in the space of a minute. Literally, knocked it over, cleaned up the spill, and immediately knocked it right over again. For someone who pays the mortgage by being professionally dexterous, I'm clumsy as hell. Especially when I'm tired. And I'm tired because I've been making stuff all week. Writing a script for a video, filming myself performing that script, and then working on the edit so I look like I know vaguely what I'm talking about. So it's a very nice kind of tired. It reminds me of when I'd come home from a long day of street performing, my back aching partly because of all the shows I'd done, but partly because my backpack had a bag of money in it from generous audiences. That was always a nice kind of ache. We're here to talk about creativity. There's a myth that creativity is some kind of magical dance with the muse, that the be-all and end-all of being creative is being able to have your brain come up with stuff, but I don't think that's true. Creativity isn't just ideas, it lives in the doing, in the journey from notion to reality, and that's where the craft and skill are developed, where bad ideas are dumped and new, better ones discovered. Creativity, I think, is mostly about how you get something that just popped into your imagination to actually materialize. Playing with the idea in your head and then seeing it in real life, well, they're the fun parts, but it's the path between them, that's where the hard work happens. Now, when I say hard work, this stuff is relative. And don't get me wrong, I'm under no illusion about my own privilege. What's hard work to an artist isn't the same as what's hard work to a nurse. When I have an idea for a trick, I can see in my mind's eye myself doing it. I can imagine how I'd perform it, where I'd put the jokes, how I'd make it funny or exciting or suspenseful, how I'd engineer the theatre out of it to get the best audience reactions. And then I'll remember that it's still just an idea, that I can't actually do the trick yet. So all of that fun performing stuff will have to wait until, oh, maybe 6 months or a year of regular practice. And even then, there's a chance I just won't click with it and won't be able to learn it. Of course, you don't need to be good at something to be creative in it. I'm a pretty shabby piano player, but I enjoy playing. I can pick out a tune and let my plinky plonky noises soothe my soul, even if it might not soothe anyone else's. However, almost all creative pursuits involve upgradable skills. From playing piano to sleight of hand to woodworking or anything else. And while you don't need to be any good at any of these things to let your creative juices flow through them, the more technical skill you have, the more mastery of your art form you achieve, then the more freedom that's going to give you to create. Practice is boring. That's one of the reasons why everyone isn't brilliant at everything. But it's also pure and beautiful in its own way. It teaches you about discipline, growth, and how failure is almost always not really failure at all. When you practice, you're paying into a bank that later your artistry will be able to draw from. The juice, as they say, is worth the squeeze. I hope your juice is keeping freshly squeezed, Bill. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I have to confess I haven't heard that expression before about the juice and the squeeze. I'm wondering if it's an Anglicism. I'm American, which means I think everything that comes out of the British Isles is of an inherently higher quality than anything we can produce over here, being the international goobers that we are. Therefore, I'm adopting this expression as my official new favorite thing. Of course, it also helps that it's true. Inspiration doesn't equal creativity. Inspiration plus work does. You don't get the juice without the squeeze. Having said that, I can't help thinking that the squeeze takes many different forms. Malcolm Gladwell popularized the idea that it takes 10,000 hours to master a new skill, a figure that was first proposed by Anders Ericsson, a professor at the University of Colorado, in a 1993 paper under the exquisitely boring title, The Role of Deliberate Practice in the Acquisition of Expert Performance. I'd bet the mortgage on my house that you spent at least 10,000 hours becoming expert in juggling, which is only one of the many arcane skills over which you now have mastery. I'd imagine I spent a similar number of hours getting good at writing, which was a point I probably reached in my early 30s after having started as a kid of about 12. What those two time spans have in common is the effort, the repetition, and the many, many, many instances of failure along the way. Here's what they don't have in common. When a novice juggler is trying to achieve proficiency, and let's uncouple that from the related but separate process of trying to achieve a style, which is a whole other episode, when that novice juggler fails, he knows it right away. He juggles and juggles and juggles. He juggles until the balls slip from his hands and hit the ground, and he bends over and picks them up, and then he goes again, and again, and again. When you're an aspiring writer, you write and write and write. This is the first part of the squeeze. But unless you're that exceedingly rare kid who's comfortable exposing your drafts to other people for comment, which I definitely was not, you very probably have no idea that you failed at all, that your writing is trite and meandering and bad. You don't see the juggling balls hit the floor, and so you're able to convince yourself, and being somebody who wants to be a writer, you're invested in convincing yourself that every syllable is gold, that the juggling balls of your words never touch the ground. By the way, for the record, the juggling balls of your words is itself very bad writing. The reason I know this is that I eventually exposed my writing to outside review by teachers and editors and readers. This is sometimes painful, but always valuable. I remember walking through my father's home office when I was about 17 and spotting in his typewriter the beginnings of the recommendation letter he was preparing to accompany my college applications. I thought about the fact that to peek at it would be to violate his process and his privacy. I thought hard about that for about a quarter of a second before I pulled it out of the rollers and took a look. My dad was an honest person. He began his letter this way. Bill Barol wants to be a writer and may very well become a good one if he stops writing like Gene Shepard. Gene Shepard being a radio host and author I was a fan of in my teens. My dad had, I assume, seen a couple of things I'd published in my high school literary magazine. They were my first publications anywhere. And he'd based his assessment on that. It was, as assessments go, brutally frank. But it wasn't wrong. He'd put his finger on something essential about the process of learning to be a writer. Although you want to read other writers, you want to absorb what's good about what they do and reject the rest. Having done that, you have to kick their voices out of your head. Because that's how you find your own voice. It's how you tune the signal. This is the second part of the squeeze, and it's everything. Was I traumatized by finding out what my dad thought about my writing? I wouldn't say so. I don't think so. But it certainly made an impression on me, enough of one that I've remembered the incident for decades. And I definitely absorbed the lesson. As certain as you may be that you're a writer for the ages, you have to take your writing out for a walk. That's where, in the bright sunlight of a reader's scrutiny, you begin to get clarity on your work. On not just what part of it may be bad, like the phrase juggling balls of your words, or, for that matter, the phrase bright sunlight of a reader's scrutiny, but also on what part of it is legitimately and honestly yours to offer. It was a long time ago now, and I have to confess that I don't remember if there was an aha moment in that process for me. A moment in which I suddenly realized that I'd achieved a basic degree of control over words and punctuation, structure and pacing, and could wield them to say what I wanted to say. I'm wondering if there was a moment like that for you. Thanks again for introducing me to my new favorite aphorism. Stay well, stay safe, and keep squeezing. Bill.
Dear Bill, I always thought that the juice is worth the squeeze was an American saying. Just seems more likely that something to do with juice might be Californian. If it was an analogy involving tea, I would totally buy it as being English. And as for your assumption that things in England are somehow classier, seriously, are you trying to set me up for a James Corden joke? Anyway, I'm not sure I completely agree with Gladwell's 10,000 hours idea. It seems perhaps just a little bit too simple. It focuses on the amount of time spent practicing, not the quality of what you do in that time. And all practice is not equal. Practice is a skill to be learned just like any other. In fact, I like to say about myself, I am far from the best juggler in the world or the best anything else, but I am pretty good at learning how to do stuff. Which means that over the last few decades, I've managed to put together quite the Swiss Army knife of useless skills. My last solo show was about exactly that. You're right, though, that most of the things I set out to learn have much more visible markers of success or failure than what you do. Juggling is, as you say, the perfect example of that. It seems to me that when it comes to success, failure, or levels of competence, juggling is digital, whereas writing is analog. Juggling, at its heart, is about not dropping, so if you drop, well, you failed at that. Writing and other creative arts, they're a little more blurred. From the first word you write, you're growing. At no point can you completely, utterly not write. There's no equivalent to dropping. But at the same time, there's no point at which you can sit back in your chair, put your feet up on your desk and say, well, I did it. I learned how to be an amazing writer. Finished. Not that one is easier than the other, they're just different kinds of difficult. But I like what dropping teaches. Every juggler, however accomplished and incredible, drops, and often. A juggler learns pretty early on not to care about the drop. It's unimportant. What matters is picking it up, having a good idea about why you dropped, and trying again. Juggling brings the learning process a rare kind of clarity. You realise pretty soon that unless you make friends with dropping, with failure, then you're not going to get anywhere at all. It seems to me that's a useful thing to remember when making stuff to put out into the world. If something doesn't work, don't spend too much time being annoyed that you dropped or that a video didn't get many views or that people didn't laugh at a joke you wrote. Spend a little time trying to work out why, but then, regardless of how you feel, get back at it. Pick up the ball, get back to juggling. I mean, sure, successes are more important than failures, but so are attempts. There's a point, though, where our two different paths of learning to do something come together. Once you can juggle with some degree of competence, or you can write in a way that people think is readable, then comes the challenge of what to do with your newfound skill. Once you're no longer worrying about keeping the balls off the floor, then you have to think about what you're going to do with them in the air. I hope you're learning from every drop. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I love learning about the things other people do. And one of the best parts of that education for me is being let in on the arcana, the inside stuff. Being a writer, I'm particularly interested in the specialized lexicons that go with different crafts. I've collected bits of these in my own career. Sitcom writers talk about a Nakamura or a sock barrel. Magazine and newspaper writers talk about killing the widow, or at least they did in the days of manual typesetting. It's a lot less horrifying than it sounds, by the way. It refers to cutting your text in such a way that you eliminate a single word hanging out on a line by itself, which is thought to be typographically ugly. And now I've learned that jugglers apparently talk about not dropping the balls, but simply about the drop as a noun, or to drop as a verb. I like this. It's efficient. It gets right to the point. Maybe I should too. So, it's interesting, your notion that practice is itself a skill. I have to confess I haven't tended to think of it that way in my own career, but rather as the long, miserable slog that leads to mastery. That parallax view may reflect the simple personality difference between us, as if there were anything simple about personality differences, but who can say? I can tell you that in my case, in the narrative of my learning how to write, I don't recall taking a lot of satisfaction in the act of practicing. In large part, this probably has to do with the fact that I was doing what amounted to on-the-job learning at a highly accelerated pace, Newsweek published every Monday, whether or not I really preferred that it wouldn't that week, and in front of an audience of millions. Fun side note, when I think of it that way, it's retrospectively terrifying, as if I'd been skating on the thinnest ice. I don't remember thinking of it that way at the time, but I was in my 20s, so if I ever had a sophisticated moment of self-awareness about my career or anything else, it probably died of loneliness. Anyway, it's a useful idea that practice time can and ought to be looked at through a lens of quality and not simply as a way of counting up to proficiency. Keeping in mind that failure isn't one undifferentiated thing, that some failures are better than others, more instructive, more laden with meaning. This gives you a way to sort them and see beyond the immediate wreckage, pick your way through, and keep going. That sorting is a critical part of the process by which you get an idea from inspiration to the page, or for that matter, to the stage. And I quite like your idea that in the case of writing, that's more an analog process than a digital one. What this analogy suggests to me is that it's messy, subjective, open to interpretation. You could, I suppose, make an argument that there is a clear-cut yes-no on-off measure of quality in my racket as well, which is, if it lacks clarity, you failed. The problem is that no two people can agree on what constitutes clarity. W. Somerset Maugham said, "There are three rules to writing. Unfortunately, no one knows what they are." People do have a sense of what it looks like to wrestle with this dilemma. The classic cartoon version is a guy sitting at his typewriter staring at the paper and then ripping it from the rollers, crumpling it up and hurling it toward a trash can. And I've been that guy. Or at least I was in the pre-computer days. It's a lot less satisfying to silently press and hold the delete key, but time marches on. Anyway, that's just the external evidence of a process that's largely internal. Yours is, to me, fascinatingly visible. It's fleshy. I'd love to hear about what it looked like or felt like for you to work out one of your tricks. What's your equivalent of crumpling up the page and lobbing it toward the wastebasket? Take care. I'll talk to you soon. And try not to drop. Bill.
Dear Bill, I love words and phrases specific to a particular trade or art form. Secret codes known only by those to whom they are useful, and at the same time little reminders of the history of the particular world in which they're understood. Street performing has a bunch of them. There's pulling in your edge, the clap and cheer, which isn't quite as simple as you might think, crate slugs, circle shows, bottling. I challenge you to guess what bottling might mean. In the meantime, please tell me where Nakamura comes from. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that by dint of our respective disciplines, we approach the act of creating something in broadly opposite ways. I'll try to lay out what I mean. A writer knows roughly what they want to say in a piece, the points they want to cover, and then the craft is in working it up until it reaches its final form and you can see what it looks like. Someone like me, though, it's the other way round. When I have an idea for a trick or a piece, I can see in my head what it will look like. All I have is the final form imagined. But the hard work is in finding out if that final form is attainable, and then, if it is, learning the damn thing. But maybe our methods are only different if you view them from one particular angle. You said you'd be interested in learning how I came up with one of my tricks. Okay then. So, for a decade and change, I've been doing a routine with cigar boxes. Cigar boxes are an interesting story in themselves. They are, as should be fairly obvious, the wooden boxes that cigars come in. I mean, they're not that, not anymore. These days they're props made for jugglers, but that's what they used to be. Back in the day, vaudeville performers started using them because they'd heard of Japanese performers doing tricks with blocks. And then they realised that in every town they'd be touring through, there would be a cigar shop where they could get old cigar boxes for free. And a variety act is, if nothing else, frugal and keen to reduce their luggage weight. Anyway, so a decade and change ago, I was contracted to do a bunch of shows on a cruise ship. A couple of weeks on, a couple of weeks off for about a year. Steady work is good in my game, so I bought some boxes and brought them along so I'd have something new to learn and not go insane with boredom. I fairly quickly learned all the basic tricks, and then I started thinking about some kind of finale stunt with them. Now, the classic big trick with the boxes is some variation of balancing them all on your face, either stacking a bunch of them end to end or having them interlock in a hard to describe kind of V formation. The V pattern is more elegant and it lets you work under a lower ceiling. Mindful of how many basement clubs I play, that seemed the wiser choice, so I learned it. So far, so nothing that other jugglers haven't done before. But to my mind, the trick was lacking something. A woof moment. My old friend Rob coined that phrase for when a performer does something that, as they say in the world of professional wrestling, pops a crowd. Balancing the boxes is good, but there's no one split second where the audience gets the message to cheer. There's no climax. Now, on cruise ships, all the glasses in all but the high-class bars are plastic. This is, I assume, because they're scared of Western-style saloon brawls, which, having been on a few cruise ships, does seem like a wise move. Anyway, I stole a few plastic martini glasses. It would be nice, I thought, to see if I could have a martini sitting on top of the big stack of boxes I was balancing. I tried it, and after realising that, happily, it was slightly easier to do with liquid in the glass because it gave it a lower centre of gravity, I found I could do it pretty reliably. Still no woof moment, though. But that martini is Chekhov's gun, right? Once you've poured a cocktail, you gotta drink it. So it slowly became obvious. Hold the balance with the martini on top for a few seconds, get some applause, and then, just as it starts to die out, take a sharp step back, let all the boxes clatter to the floor, and then catch the martini at the last moment without spilling a drop. Toast the audience, drink it, and there's your climax. I love that routine. And if you want to see it, we'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's paying tribute to the history of my art form by using an old vaudeville prop, an opening with tricks that others have done before me for generations. But then it's got my own little twist on it, which came mostly from boredom and having access to plastic glasses, just in the same way that cigar boxes themselves came from vaudevillians having access to cigar shops. So I guess you're right about my process being external and yours being internal. That routine came from, basically, bored fidgeting. Is there a writer's version of that? You also mentioned that my way is more fleshy. Well, that's certainly true when you're working on cruise ships. 24-hour buffets mean that, as the old joke goes, you come on as a passenger and you leave as freight. I hope you're still a happy passenger. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Ah, the Nakamura. The bane of sitcom writers. One of them, anyway. Sitcom writers have a lot of banes, because there are oh so many ways the souffle of scripted comedy performed before a live audience can fall. Here's the origin story as it was passed down to me. Years ago, on some sitcom which is now lost to the mists of time, the writers fell in love with the sound of the name Nakamura and contrived a joke to which it was the punchline. It struck them as so extremely and reliably hilarious that they decided to stitch it right through the episode. Because if it's funny once, it's funnier if you call it back half a dozen times, right? Friday night comes. The episode is up on its feet for a live taping. The audience is in their seats. It's going well. And the writers are assembled on the stage floor, giddy with anticipation. And here it comes. The first instance of the crowd-leveling force of nature that is the Nakamura joke. And it dies. Crickets. Actual tumbleweeds roll forlornly across the stage. That's not the bad part. The bad part is, one by one, it dawns on the members of the writing staff that they are going to have to listen to that awful, awful silence five more times. That silence is the price of their hubris. A joke the writers love so much that they lace it through the episode and then have to listen to it die a death every single time. That's a Nakamura. One of the things I love about that story is that it says even professionals can utterly screw the pooch in the practice of their craft. It's a story about comedy, and comedy is its own thing, to be sure. It's delicate in particular ways. A joke, a bit, a runner, a whole show can fail because it's 3 degrees too warm on the stage and the audience is just the tiniest bit uncomfortable. But it's true of every kind of creative endeavor. There are no guarantees. And catastrophic miscalculation is part of the process. And sometimes you fail in ways that aren't useful. You just fail. You pick yourself up and go on. And you try not to fall too hard for any particular piece of business, because that way lies heartbreak. You also asked if there's a writer's version of the fidgeting that led to your cigar box bit. That's hard for me to say, because to me, all of writing is fidgeting. Sam Sifton, a New York Times writer and editor, described the difference between the two jobs this way. Editing is about leadership and ideas and working a room. Writing is about fear and panic and typing. It's certainly been that way for me. We're here to talk about the work involved in bringing an idea from first thought to final product. And for me, that process has always been laborious because, unlike you, with that beautiful precognition of a finished bit playing in your head, I rarely start with an idea of what I'm trying to say. I find what I'm trying to say in the writing. Newsweekly writers had a name for this. They called it breaking rocks because it's a process of applying force to a recalcitrant material. I try out ideas, follow paths, abandon them, double back, start again. And if I'm honest, the fear that I'm never going to be able to whack a trail through the underbrush of my own half-baked thoughts is always there. Do I panic? Well, rarely anymore. Experience teaches you to leave breadcrumbs behind. Maybe experience is itself the breadcrumbs. At any rate, I can always wind my way back. So, am I panicky? No. But am I fearful? Every time I sit down at the keyboard. Maybe that fear is what makes it so satisfying to read back a well-crafted paragraph, or even a single sentence that's light on its feet. When you've managed to bring enough of your technique to bear that you figure out what it is you're trying to say, it's like emerging into a sunlit clearing, and the path of process that took you there vanishes behind you. You barely even remember it was there. There'll be another one next time. For the moment, though, you get to enjoy the light. Take care, stay well, and stay in the light. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com. Thank you.